If we could start with the agenda, I'm going to again navigate around with this in the interest of time. Item one, approval of meeting minutes of the May 17th virtual meeting. What's the board's pleasure on item one?
So moved.
Motion is made. Is there discussion on the motion? Excuse me. Is there a second to the motion? I'm sorry.
Second.
So is there discussion on the motion? In the absence of a motion properly made and second, all in favor indicate by voice vote. Trustee Graves?
Yes.
Trustee Elliker?
Yes.
Trustee Petra Simone?
Aye.
Trustee Sagnella is aye. And Trustee Gormley is not here yet, right? Okay, if we can go on to, we'll put item two on hold for a moment. Go on to item three. This item is information only, does not require the deliberation or vote of the trustees. Is there any question on item three that the trustees might have? Item four, contribution withdrawals, again, information only, does not require the deliberation or consent of the board. Are there any questions the trustees might have on item four? Item five, death after retirement. I'd like to take item five and item six together. Death after retirement and death while active. Carol Woolsey, Nancy Huff, Charles Brooks, Shirley Rayner are under death after retirement. Death while an active member, Joanne Godnick. If I can request the trustees for a moment of silence for the repose of the souls of these individuals, I appreciate it. Thank you. Rest in peace. Item seven, payment of bills. It's the board's pleasure on the payment of the bills.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Is there discussion on that motion? In the absence of a motion and properly made a second, I'd like to call upon the trustees for their voice vote. Trustee Graves?
Yes.
Trustee Elliker?
Yes.
Trustee Petra Simone?
Aye.
Trustee Sagnella is also aye.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there any old business the trustees would like to brought up on the agenda? Have brought up on the agenda? Is there any new business that the trustees would like to have entertained? If not, I'd like to return back to item two, administrative matters. Under A, outside earnings update, incomplete application information only. Can staff report on that?
Yes. Hi, Jerry. It's Leanna.
Hi, Leanna.
Every year around this time, we just notify the trustees how many retirees have not submitted. We mail it out around February 1st, and they have until April 30th of each year. This is for those who are both SERF and PNF on a disability pension, and they have an outside earnings cap, so they have to submit an affidavit along with their, for SERF, their 1040 tax filing. So, you know, those who do not submit by the 30th of April, we send a follow-up letter on May 1st. And then we also, those who have not submitted by June 1st, we send a certified letter, notifying them that if we don't receive it, then their pension will be, turned off for the month of June. And then it'll be turned back on once they comply and submit what they need to. And of course we would give any retro owed. So currently this month we are down to three people who still have not submitted. So they have been inactivated currently. And when we do receive, you know, what is needed from them, we will turn that back on.
Okay. Leon, I'm just curious, is the are they still conducting those death audits?
Yes.
That's done how often? Is that quarterly?
Quarterly we get those, yeah. And but honestly, on a weekly basis, one of my staff members checks legacy and online obituaries to find some ourselves, but then Northern Trust sends us a quarterly death audit, which is sort of more for live checks that have gone uncashed, that we then look into as well. Go ahead. And then you're right. The death audit also, you know, through Northern Trust also, where if they find through Social Security or through obituaries of people who have passed away, you know, we also check that quarterly as well.
Anecdotally speaking, just as a quick story, we did have a situation where an individual that was receiving a pension from SURF passed away, and the daughter did not notify SURF that she had passed away. And at some point, the death audit caught up with the situation, and that individual was prosecuted and had to return like $37,000 worth of benefits back to the SURF fund. So again, these things happen, and it's a very valuable thing to have that death audit conducted on a regular basis. Very good, Liana. Okay, anything else to report under that, Andre?
No, we're all set on item A.
So there are people who are gonna have their pension suspended unless they apply.
Yeah, correct. Three of them have been turned off so far for the month of June. Once we receive it from them, we will turn it back on. One person actually, she's been turned off since last year. We shut her off last year. We sent certified mail last year. We sent certified mail this year. We've called, it rings. The certified mail gets returned to us and she still doesn't submit it. So she's been inactive for an entire year.
That's one of the things that they had notified us at the time is sometimes a dead giveaway of a potential problem. Because if somebody has been getting checks on a regular basis and you stop the check, I mean, human nature being what it is, you're going to get some kind of a response. And if you don't, the question looms, you know, well, I mean, has this person been put to a home? Have they died? And if so, you know, how long ago did that happen? And if somebody was receiving those checks and cashing them, how far back did that problem go?
Yeah, so she's been off for an entire year, and we have not found her. We've continuously searched obituaries, Googled her name, all of that. We haven't found her, so she'll remain off until she reaches out to us. Maybe she knows she's over income, so she's not even bothering. I'm not quite sure.
Carolyn, what else is there much that we can do legally to, I think we've pretty much know what we're required to do to try to address the situation.
I agree with that, yes.
Okay. All right, thank you very much for conducting that death audit. As a member of the fund and a recipient of a pension, it makes me feel better. But one other question, Carolyn. If somebody's entitled to the benefit and the benefit is continuing to be paid and nobody, and the individual at the other end is not receiving it, what happens to that money in the fund? Whose money does that be? I mean, it's not the fund's money at that point, technically, is it?
No. I mean, you know, we've talked about a sheeting to the state.
Right.
Contributions. And it's complicated. We have a memo on this, which I could talk about sometime.
Yeah, at some point, that a sheeting is a... I remember us bringing that up. If it's not money that we can't keep, then automatically the state has to take that money. And every once in a while, I remember in the newspaper, they have a list of 20,000 people that the state's holding money for them to try to claim it. Don't knock yourself out, Carolyn, but at some point, if you could just give us a little heads up on that, I appreciate it.
Sure. No, I have a memo on it. I can talk to you. Yes.
Thank you. Are we on B now, discussion of outside earnings cap?
Yeah, this is Leanna. I did want to discuss something or bring something up with the trustees, which since we were already talking about the outside earnings cap briefly, just to refresh the trustees, the way that this outside earnings cap works is when you retire on a disability pension, whether service or non-service, until the age of 65, you have an outside earnings cap, which means not including your pension, but anything else, any other job. The cap is $6,800 a year. Anything over that, the amount over that is divided by 2 and then divided by 12. And that's how much your pension is reduced every month for the next 12 months. Personally, I think that $6,800 is very low, and I wasn't quite sure where that came from. So we looked into it a little bit, and that $6,800 goes back to 1984, and it has never changed. So over 40 years, the cap's been $6,800. And just by putting $6,800 into like Google conversion calculator, $6,800 in 1984 is equivalent to about $20,000 today in 2023. So to me, that's just a huge difference. I'm not quite saying it's not fair. I don't know everyone's thoughts on it, but especially since COVID, there's been so many more job opportunities to be done from home. So perhaps a SERF member who was a school security guard, driving garbage trucks for the city of New Haven, whatever the case may be, gets disabled, cannot do those jobs anymore. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're unable to perform a job, you know, from the comfort of their home, at a computer. Also, most of these people, their pension, you know, is roughly $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, maybe $30,000 a year. And then, you know, we're saying there's a cap of an extra $6,800, which is still well below, how much it costs to survive today. So currently this year, obviously we can't do anything for this year, but I just wanted to bring it to your attention to see if how you guys felt about it. If you guys felt, you know, you'd want to possibly raise the cap. Currently there's 8 retirees who are over income this year, so they have their pension reduced. And out of 8 of them, I did check, and only one of them is over $20,000. Everyone else actually is under, you know, their outside earnings is under $20,000. So again, just something, I don't know, to bring up, to think about, to see how you guys felt about it. I think if we were interested, the best route would maybe be to try to squeeze it into a contract to kind of set precedent for all the other unions, but I could be wrong on that.
Well, Carolyn, that's my question. Is what we're looking at here beyond our control as fiduciaries? It would have to be done through collective bargaining. I mean, right. We could send a letter to the labor relations director, the trustees, endorsing such a change, but as far as definitively making a change, I don't think we have that authority.
That's correct. It would either have to be in a collective bargaining agreement or in a memorandum of understanding with the unions.
Which we do not have the power to provide.
Right. But as you said, if the trustees could send a letter or, you know, urge labor relations to make this change.
Yeah, I'm amenable to looking at that. You know, once we can come up with a figure that we think is commensurable or more representative of the times. That's my opinion as a trustee. The other trustees are in agreement.
Just if I may, to my recollection, this is not something that was requested by the union.
So it was not requested by the union. We've had we've had multiple retirees on disability when they're submitting these outside earnings, of course, who have other jobs. They've kind of, you know, put up a fuss or a fight about it, saying, what's $6,800? Like, who can live off of $6,800 anyways? So with them saying that is kind of what ignited me looking into it.
Gary, I have a question.
Sure.
I thought that $6,800 was mandated by the federal government.
No.
That amount. I thought that was the limit based so that we could, it's not.
To my knowledge, that's never been the case. That's been a local issue.
It's a local issue. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I understand the mayor's point. I mean, if the union hasn't brought it up, they haven't brought it up. But correct me if I'm wrong, Carolyn, I think there have been pension issues that have arisen in the past that required, that came to the attention of the trustees that required some remedial action. And we did the same type of thing. We endorsed the concept, but we left it up to the union to determine if they wanted to raise it officially as an issue for the collective bargaining.
I think that's correct. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, I think I think it would be fine for us to suggest something, but we've finished negotiating most of the contracts that have been up in the last year, 2 years that would impact this. So to kind of reopen things would be a bit of a hassle.
But there could be a memorandum of understanding just on this one issue, right, Carol?
Yes.
Well, I mean, as one individual, it would be my opinion that I'm amenable to endorse the issue being brought to the respective unions for them to raise it, and if it could be handled without, you know, going through the whole collective bargaining process again, which I understand it can be difficult, and just to handle individually as one issue through a memorandum of understanding, which I know we've done before. And then each union signed off on it individually with labor relations. I'm all for that. I would leave it up to administration to try to work on what they think is a figure that is more compatible today to the times, whether that means looking at other pension funds, other municipal pension funds, and see what, you know, what they're using as their cap. But I'm in favor of that. And if you'd like to take a vote on it, that's fine with me. I think I just made a motion.
Is this something we need to vote on just to move forward with research?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think I made a motion. Carolyn, the chair can make a motion, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, I made a motion that the issue brought, that the fund be supportive and endorse the concept of an increase to the cost of living. The outside earnings cap to make it more reflective of the times. And that, you know, we would send that, vocalize that endorsement to the Office of Labor Relations and to the respective member unions. And then it's up to them to determine if they want to go ahead and pursue it through a memorandum of understanding. So that's my motion.
I'll second it.
Motion has been made. It's been seconded. Is there discussion on the motion? In the absence of a motion been properly made and seconded, I'd like to call upon the trustees for their voice vote. Trustee Graves?
Yes.
Trustee Elliker?
No.
Trustee Petra Simone?
Not sure.
Trustee Gormany? Trustee Sagnoli is yes.
Sorry.
I beg your pardon?
Mike Gormany, sorry. Sorry, couldn't get on mute. No.
Will you vote, Mike?
No.
Okay. And Trustee Sagnell is an aye. What does that work out to mathematically?
Doesn't carry.
It doesn't carry.
All right. We'll go on to other business. Item C, presentation of changes to the pension provisions and the new collective bargaining agreements with Local 3144 and Local 884. Liana, can you comment, please?
Yes. Recently, we received new contracts for Local 884, Local 3144. They've been passed by the Board of Alders, but I think they're still not signed. But we did receive versions of pretty much what the contracts will be. We've also received the nurses, the attorneys, and the Parks Department within the last couple of months. I had asked labor if anyone could come and discuss the changes because I was not involved at all in any of the changes. The first time I received it was, you know, whenever I got the email. So I did give you what they provided for the Local 3144 and Local 884 changes. There are pretty significant changes. So I did ask David Mendel from Hooker and Holcomb to discuss some of them that he has knowledge on.
Yes, thank you, Leanna. As Leanna was saying, we were recently provided with the new CBAs for Local 3144 Management and Local 884 Clerical. And Leanna asked me to come in today to give a brief summary of the changes to the pension plan provisions. I'm going to share screen right now so you can see the document I'm looking at. Just let me know or stop me if you can't see this. But just to give a quick overview of the table here, the top column, Local 3144, bottom, Local 884.
David, I can't see it. I'm not sure if other folks can, but
let me do it again. Sorry. Thank you.
That's better.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect. Thank you again. Okay. So again, this is the document. I just put this together for today's meeting just to provide a brief summary of the changes to the pension plan provisions for the new CBAs. So the top row, Local 3144, Management. The bottom row, Local 884, Clerical. The middle column is the provisions for the prior CBA. The right column is the new CBA, the new contracts. Now I'm just gonna go through them one by one so you know of all the changes coming. So we'll start with Local 3144. Employee contribution percent, it was 10%. Now it's going up to 10.5%. That means slightly more money out of each employee's paycheck is going into the pension trust. Retirement age, this is a big change, though it only applies to new employees, meaning employees hired after this ratification date. So the ramifications won't be seen for a while because it really only applies to people hired in the future. But previously, your employees were retiring on rule of 80 or 85, depending on their tier. That means age plus service equals 80 or 85. You can retire unreduced. Now it's just age 65. So for new employees, you're removing the rule of or point of system and switching to a flat age 65. What this means is people will retire later. The next change, early retirement reduction. If you were going to retire before the normal retirement date, there's a reduction per year earlier retiring. Previously, it was 2% for certain tiers hired prior to 2003, 3.5% per year for everyone else. Now it's changing to 3% per year if you're hired before 2013, 3.5% per year for everyone else. That's just a slight change. And then the last change for Local 3144, this is a big change. This is in regards to current employees and new employees. So this goes into effect immediately, even if you were hired 20 years ago. And this is the form of annuity you're given at retirement. So the prior CBA, the way it worked was if you were unmarried at retirement, you received a life annuity. Your pension was going to cover just you for the rest of your life, no spousal benefit. If you were married at the time of retirement, you were provided with a life annuity. And then if you predeceased your spouse, if you died before them, 50% of your benefit was then given, 50% of your monthly benefit was then given to your spouse for the rest of their life. The new CBA allows for five different forms of annuities that you can choose from. So at retirement, your retirees are going to choose from one of these annuities, and then it's locked in place for the rest of their life. So the five different annuities, a life annuity covering just you for the rest of your life that was already there, a 10-year certain in life annuity, which means You and your estate are guaranteed 10 years of pension payments, regardless of when you die, when your spouse dies. 10 years of pension payments has to go to your estate, even if you die. And then after the 10 years, it's just a normal life annuity that covers you for the rest of your life. 100% joint and survivor, which previously was 50%, 100% just means your spouse gets, once you pass away, your spouse receive 100% of the pension you are receiving. 75%, they receive 75% of the pension receiving. And then 50% joint and survivor, which you currently have. The big difference, aside from offering these different forms of annuities, is each one comes with an actuarial reduction. So before you were just giving away the 50% joint and survivor, it automatically covered a spouse if they were married. Now, if you elect a 50% joint and survivor, it means your pension will be reduced permanently to cover that spouse. And now that reduction, the amount of the reduction is determined by your actuary at the time of retirement. So that was a lot to go over right there. I'm going to pause for questions about those new forms of annuity. And if there are none, I'll move on to the changes to Local 884.
Well, David, if like Mark and I are already retired for a while now, this would have no bearing on us for the survivorship for our spouses.
Correct. The new CBA is only in regards to current employees. Current retirees have no change to anything.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions before I go on to Local 884?
David, this is Leanna. I might have missed if you said it. Did you mention that it does not need to be a spouse?
Oh, no, I did not mention that. Thank you, Leanna. So previously, you could only have the joint and survivor if you had a spouse. These new forms of annuities, if you don't have a spouse, you are allowed to choose a non-spouse beneficiary. If you wanted to cover a sibling, a parent, a child, you can choose a different beneficiary. So there are, in general, more options for your employees to choose from at retirement. And while I'm on that topic, the amount of reduction to your pension benefit for choosing one of these other forms of annuities is going to depend on the employee's age at retirement and their spouse's age at retirement. So if you are significantly older than your beneficiary, there is a larger actuarial reduction to your pension, because the reality is you're just going to pay out that younger beneficiary, or you're expected to pay them out longer. So your pension gets reduced by more. But each of these five annuities at time of retirement, your actuary comes in, calculates what the benefit will be for choosing one of these, and they're all considered actuarially equivalent in our eyes. The present value of any of the annuity you choose will be equal in our eyes. So you're not really benefiting in our eyes by choosing one or the other. They're all equivalent.
When does this become effective? Or is it effective now?
It's effective immediately. I believe Leanna said another signature is needed from the mayor, but we're essentially, these new contracts are effective immediately. And that provision we just talked about, the form of annuity, does impact all current employees, regardless of when you were hired.
So yeah, Leanna's office this afternoon in whichever process they use and said, I want to retire. Would they just make it?
Jerry, this is Leanna. That's where I was confused by too, but I did reach out to labor and they did say that these are like effective immediately. So yeah, if someone's been employed for 30 years and they go to retire today, tomorrow, whatever, under 3144, I think they fall under all these new, you know, all these new options. So it is going to take time. We have to obviously create new forms. The actuary has to update the portal. So, we literally just got this probably like a week and a half ago. So we're working on it. But it was a little unclear, but I did reach out to labor and they did say it's effective immediately. Some of the contracts, the changes were for new hires only. So it's just new hires moving forward have these changes, but the 3144 and the 884, it's for current employees.
Do you think that the employees of these two unions are adequately aware of that? I understand that, you know, it's their responsibility to read contracts, but on major issues like this, you think there should have been some announcement that this is going to happen to make sure they understand this? Because you might have gotten a flood of people that said, well, I want to make it in to retire, you know, before this becomes effective.
Again, I think it already has become effective because this was read. I asked Labor the ratification dates for these, and it was June 5th. There were, at least on 3144, because that's what I'm a member of, there were a couple union meetings that went over most of the changes. And I think there's actually a union meeting tonight. So perhaps they're going to go over it again. But everyone already voted, and this was passed by the Board of Alders on June 5th.
So you think that people are adequately aware of this, and if they wanted to, you know, to get in under the deadline, they could have done that?
I mean, I don't know how well aware they were of everything, but there was discussion around what the changes were going to be from the meeting that I went to. And there were other limits, like for other things in the contract, you have to remain an employee, like to get retro and all of that. So I suppose people made their decisions based on what worked best for them.
David, these type of changes, I mean, I'm sure there's a report somewhere to the Mayor of Labor Relations, but do you take these changes and equate what that converts to in terms of savings to the fund?
Yes. We have put together a cost analysis for each new collective bargaining agreement.
I'd like to see that at some point. If you could just show us, you know, what the fund serves. It looks like the fund is going to actually save with these changes that are being made.
Yes, I can provide that to you. I'll mention one thing. So the summary you're looking at on my screen right here,
yeah,
this doesn't include a big change that the cost analysis did, and that's in regards to people's salary. So everyone's salary got a large increase, and then salary scale went up from 2% to 3%. So that's not included in my table here, but that will be included in the cost analysis.
Yeah, I'd appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you. Are there any other questions on item C?
Oh, well, I don't think we're done. This is Carolyn. I have a little bit to add in. I don't think
David... Go right ahead.
No, but David hasn't finished with 884, correct?
I'm sorry.
Yes, no problem. I'll quickly do 884. It's more of the same as 3144, so it won't take as long. But so the changes to Local 884 Clerical, another large union, retirement age, and this applies to only new employees. They're switching rule of 80 and 85 to age 65, same as 3144. Early retirement reduction. It was 2% per year or 3.5% per year, depending on your tier. Now it's going to be 5% per year. That's different than 3144, so more of an early retirement reduction.
David, and I thought 3144 also had the 5%.
I may have mentioned that to you yesterday, and then I looked over the contract, okay, and it said 3.5. So I may have misspoke the other day.
Okay.
Yes. And then aside from early retirement reduction factor, Local 884 is also switching to the different optional forms of annuities for both new employees and current employees. The same five options, spouse or non-spouse beneficiary. And then Caroline, I can pass it to you for the next conversation.
Yep. So one of the changes to both of these contracts, and I'm not sure if they're also the same change for the other three that Leanna mentioned, is that if you are 60, you have the option of not joining SERF and of taking Social Security. And we have suggested some implementation changes so that it runs more smoothly when people make that choice. For new employees, we've suggested that they need to make that election in writing within 30 days of hire. And with current employees, we've suggested that they make that election within 6 months, and then they're entitled to a refund of their contributions. So 6 months of ratification. And I understand that Labor Relations is working on a letter to add to the collective bargaining agreements that would have those administrative changes. We know based on the past when people have made elections, it can get confusing, as to whether they've made the election, whether they've had notice of time to make election, whether it's too late to make the election, trying to avoid all those problems.
Any other commentary? Trustees, have any further questions?
I just want to add, thank you, Carolyn, because in some instances, people weren't given the option to make an election.
Right, and that becomes hard for the staff. Like, were they given the option, you know, making a factual determination and that kind of thing? So
yeah, some were not given the option.
Right, so we try to do it. Now it's all in writing and with time limits.
Any further discussion or commentary? Questions? Thank you, David.
You're welcome.
Item D, presentation by Brenna Saltzman and Wallman of Memorandum Regarding Plan Document 2023 Update, Effective of Secure Act 2.0. What exactly does that mean?
That's Jack. We'll be making that.
Okay, piece. Jack, you're on the air.
Okay, this follows naturally from this prior discussion. It's honestly not a big deal, the thing we've been dealing with compared to these big changes in the contracts, but they are a reason why it's time to do a full restatement of the plan document. We've been thinking about this for some time. We think we need to pick up on several things that have happened since the last IRS determination was received in 2017. And this memorandum goes through some liberalization that's recently happened that's going to enable us to cure a particular plan glitch that has been around for a while. And I'm speaking of the over age 40 service disability issue. If you recall, the plan document says that anyone who is hired after age 40 and goes out on a service-related disability will have his or her pension computed based on final pay. In practice, for many years, the plan has paid out based on the higher of final pay or best average. So for a relative handful of people who are in a declining earnings situation, they have technically been overpaid if the operative factor was average, best average pay rather than final pay. A way of curing an overpayment under existing IRS guidelines, and the simplest way, is simply to retroactively amend the plan to make what happened be the right thing. And some time ago, this was discussed, and that's the course that the trustees decided to take. We have been thinking of an interim step of going to the IRS on this problem under the Voluntary Corrections Program. That's a conservative view. It has been a conservative view. It depends on whether one views this as a significant discrepancy or not. Based on the number of employees and the size of the money involved, it's certainly not significant. The only thing that gave us pause was the length of time it's been going on. And there has been a recent development, an act of Congress called Secure Act 2.0. It was signed into law on December 28th. And the IRS came out with some guidance on it as recently as a couple of weeks ago to make clear that you can self-correct now whether the discrepancy is significant or not if it's an eligible, quote, inadvertent failure. And we think that this would qualify as that, and we think it would fully qualify for retroactive cure. And we now believe that under the Secure Act, we can just simply skip the voluntary corrections program filing with the IRS and go right to folding in this cure as part of a 2023 restatement. at the end of the memorandum, and you can read or not read the things about the SECURE Act, we have listed the things that we think should be done in a new update. One is to cure the over 40 disability issue, as I've just said. We need to check for any changes in the IRS law and regulations that have occurred since the last determination letter and make sure those are covered. We need to incorporate a bunch of little standalone amendments that were made in connection with the 2020 IRS private ruling on tax-free disability benefits. There were some little language changes that had to go out to all the unions for MOUs to just change a bit of language to make it more like the workers' compensation language as to what is a service disability. And then all of these collective bargaining changes are pretty significant. We've got new unions, the attorneys and who was it, the nurses. And now we've got parks, I think, coming into the picture that need to be covered under the revised plan document. And all the changes David has just been discussing are pretty significant changes as to the methods of payout and the calculation numbers. So all of this we would like to present for approval by the board of our drafting of a 2023 full restatement of the plan, incorporating all the things I've described, and get that done this year. So I'll turn it back to the chair to entertain any questions or any needed vote on whether a 2023 restatement of the plan is authorized.
So, Jack, just to interrupt you, I think already the board authorized us months ago to restate the plan. So,
and that's my recollection.
Yeah, I don't think we need to do another vote.
Just one question, David. I'm sorry, Jack. Mandatorily, that has to be done at some point anyways by Internal Revenue requirement, right? A restatement of the plan.
Well, it's up to the plan these days. You used to have to go in every 5 years to the IRS for approval. The last such approval was the 2017 letter. They discontinued that program. It is now a self-help, self-monitoring situation where the plan needs to update on its own as required. There is some assistance from the IRS with a publication of so-called requirements amendments lists every year that will describe what needs to be done and the effective dates, which are fairly generous in the future, generally when something happens. So it's now not a requirement, but there are effective dates and we need to get it done to the extent that it applies with new legislation or regulations.
I agree it should be done, but my only question, just out of curiosity, does the Internal Revenue charge a fee for that?
No, you don't file with them anymore. You don't need to pay a fee. And what we've discussing eliminating was that interim step we were going to take, which would have required a fee.
Okay.
So, no, you just do it. You don't file it. And you stand ready to defend what you've done.
All right. Is there a motion for the trustees to allow legal counsel to proceed with the restatement of the plan?
Jerry, it's Carolyn. I think
you don't need it. That's right. We've discussed this before.
Yes,
I apologize.
And for it. No.
What was authorized? Yeah. I'm sorry. What was authorized before was to go to the IRS with this interim step, and we're eliminating that.
No, they authorized us to rewrite the plan.
Yes, both were authorized actually, yes. But we're eliminating the VCP.
Right. So in effect, you already have the authority to do this.
Yes.
Yes.
You're just explaining what you're going to do.
Right.
Okay. Is there any questions on item D? Any commentary? If not, we can go on to item E, review of a proposed agreement for legal services with Brenner Saltzman and Wallman.
So this is Carolyn. Last month, you authorized our firm to continue, and thank you, as your legal counsel for the next 3 years. And so Taylor or Leanna, can you share the redlined version of the proposed legal services contract? So what I've done is take the old one that you approved, and I'll quickly go through the changes. So the recitals previously had talked about an RFP, but we didn't do an RFP this time. So I changed that language just to say that we'd been your counsel for a long time and that you had authorized us to continue. If you could go to the next page. So the effective is 3 years. It's just sort of a typo kind of change. In terms of, yeah, if you could just keep scrolling up, that'd be great. Jill is no longer with our firm. And then we've changed our paralegal from Jeannie to Joanna. And that's, again, a sort of a typo. I updated the code of conduct. We amended it in 2020. So on the fees, and that this is probably the most important, we kept our flat fee at $6,000 and we kept our hourly rate at $300 an hour. You had voted last time to do the flat fee for the first year of the contract, and this provides that every year you get to decide whether or not you want to continue with the flat fee or you want to continue or you want to switch it to an hourly rate. So that's what that says. And the insurance remains the same. And the termination, to deal with what do we do with our hundreds and hundreds of files that we have. And previously it said that you'll basically pick them up or authorize us to destroy them. But what if you don't do either? So I said that we keep them for 7 years. We would just use our usual retention policy. And then so that's really changed. I added first class mail if you wanted to terminate us. And then keep going. Good. So it's the same legal services, everything that we do for you. And this is where the really big changes are. So instead of having a monthly retainer for routine matters and extra fees for quadro review and extra fees, if you could keep going for, if you could just keep for investment transaction review and for extraordinary projects, I just said, look, it's going to be $6,000 for a month for everything if you elect that, except for litigation. So all of those other items, which we really never charged you for, have been eliminated. It's just a flat $6,000. And everything else remains the same. Insurance remains the same. $10 million coverage for legal malpractice. And I think that's it. So if anybody has questions, I don't know if you want to put it back up for questions, but.
Well, I'm just curious about this. I don't have my calculator. I'm just looking at, the flat fee compared to the hourly. Liana, could you do me a favor? If you could just take $6,000 per month, 12 months is $72,000. Can you just divide 300 into that? I'm just trying to get an idea of how many hours that would be the equivalent of. And I'm sure you probably work more than that.
240. 72,000 divided by 300, you said?
Yep.
240. Is that?
Yeah, so they'd have to work, if they were getting paid the 300 per hour fee, they'd have to work 240 before to be equivalent of the 6,000 per month. Then anything above that would be over the 72,000. I'm all right with staying with $6,000 per month. I mean, 240, that comes to like 20 hours a month, right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
Carolyn, do they need to vote on this new contract?
No, they voted on the contract language, right? Yes.
Okay, so it needs to be a vote and then Jerry would need to sign.
Yes, and yes, that's correct.
I move that we approve the amended language to the contract, or move to approve the new contract as proposed by Attorney Cohen.
Motion is made. Second.
I'll second.
Is there a discussion on the motion? In the absence of a motion properly made and second, I'd like to call for the trustees' vote, voice vote. Trustee Graves?
Yes.
Trustee Ulliker?
Yes.
Trustee Petrosimone?
Aye.
Trustee Gormany?
Yes.
And Trustee Sagnol is yes also.
Thank you very, very much.
Okay.
Jerry, I'll email it to you to sign.
You want me to sign it?
It's ready. Derek, you're not here today for your deep dive, but if you could just give us a quick commentary on how the market looks in terms of the fund. I think the trustees have places to go. So
sure,
if you could summarize it.
Absolutely. So we're kind of in a holding pattern here as far as, you know, watching Fed action. The market's rallied a bit, but we think that we're going to get into more choppy territory. I mean, we are not overly enthused with the market rallies. It's been led by, you know, 7 or 8 tech names, you know, large tech names. You know, Fed paused this month. There's a chance they may hike next month, but so we're just keeping a watchful eye on that. But you know, we're positioned well. We just hired the new bond manager, so we're adding to fixed income momentarily sometime this month. We're trying to squeeze out a positive June, which it looks like, hopefully, knock on wood, we can, to come to a solid fiscal year end. So all is okay, I'll say. You know, not great, not bad. We're kind of just treading water here.
Thank you, Derek.
You're welcome.
Are there any further questions of Derek? If not, I think it's in order to ask the trustees the motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Is there
discussion on this motion? In the absence of motion properly made, call upon the trustees by name. Voice vote, Trustee Graves.
Aye.
Trustee Ulliker?
Yes.
Trustee Petrosimone?
Aye.
Trustee Gormany? And Trustee Sagnella is also a yes. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Enjoy yourself. Have a nice month.
Trustee Gormany.
Soon. Stay safe.
Jerry and Mike.
I'm going to stay back to discuss
this issue. Have a great day, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.